Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjani Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjani Hari. Jai Gopi Jana Vallabha Krishna Dhari. Jai Gopi Jana Vallabha Krishna Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Jamuna Tira Vanajari. Jamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 12, Chapter 3, Text Number 1. So we'll have a nice introduction to the chapter, which explains a little bit more about what we're doing, what's going on in the world. And it begins the chapter titled The Bhumi Gita, The Song of the Earth. Very beautiful prayers. Because this is the one time in the existence of the earth during this Kali Yuga that the earth is wary of what's about to happen. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Chapter 3, Canto 12, the Bhumi Gita, summarization. This chapter describes how the earth took note of the foolishness of the many kings bent on conquering her. It also describes how even though the age of Kali is full of faults, the glorification of the holy name of Lord Hari destroys them all. Great kings who are actually just playthings of death desire to subdue their six internal enemies, the five senses and the mind. And afterward, they imagine they will go on to conquer the earth and all its oceans. Seeing their false hopes, the earth simply laughs, for eventually they must all leave this planet and go elsewhere, as have all the great kings and monarchs of the past. Moreover, after usurping the earth, or some part of it, which is actually unconquerable and must in every case be given up. Fathers, sons, brothers, friends, and relatives quarrel over it. Sorry, a bit of a cold.
Okay, Hare Krishna.
The study of history naturally leads to the conclusion that all worldly achievements are temporary. And this conclusion should give rise to a sense of renunciation. Ultimately, the highest goal of life for any living entity is pure devotion to Lord Krishna, which annihilates all inauspiciousness. In the age of Satya, religion was complete, still possessing its four legs of truth, mercy, austerity, and charity. With the coming of each age, succeeding age, starting with Treta, these religious qualities are diminished by one quarter. In the Kali Yuga, the legs of religion retain only one-fourth of their power, and even that will be lost with the progress of the age. This mode of goodness is predominant during Satya Yuga, and the mode of passion is predominant during the Treta Yuga. The mixed modes of passion and ignorance, the predominating during the Dwarapa Yuga, that's the time that Krishna appeared, and in the age of Kali, the mode of ignorance is predominant. Atheism, the smallness and inferiority of all things, and the devotion to the genitals and belly are very much evident in the age of Kali. Living entities, contaminated by the influence of Kali, do not worship the Supreme Lord Hari, even though they can be freed from all bondage and easily achieve the supreme destination simply by chanting the glories of his name and taking shelter of him. But if somehow or other the Supreme Personality of Godhead becomes manifest within the hearts of the conditioned souls in Kali Yuga, then all faults of place, time, personality inherent in the age will be destroyed. Kali Yuga is an ocean of faults, but it possesses one great quality. Simply by the chanting of the holy names of Krishna, one can be delivered from material association and obtain the absolute truth. All this was accomplished in the age of Satya by meditation, in the age of Treta by sacrificial performances, and in the age of Dwarapa by temple worship is easily gained during the Kali Yuga simply by the process of Hari Kirtan. Text 1. Did I chant Om Namo Bhagavate? I did, right? Okay, start again. Shri Suku Uvacha Dresvatmane Jaye Vagyan Nripan Hasati Puriyam Aho Ma Vedigi Shanti Mritho Kridanka Nrupa. Yeah, it's got an extra line there, Sam. Shri Suku Vacha Dristvatmani Jaya Vagran Nripan Hasati Bhuridam Aho ma veji gi shanti Mritho kridanna ka nripa. Word for word, Sri Shuka Uvacha. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, Dristva, observing, Atmani, of herself, Jaye, in conquest. Vagran, busily engaged. Nripan, the king. Asati, she laughs. Bhu, the earth. Iyam, this. A who? Ah. Ma. Me. Vidigisanti. They are desiring to conquer. Mrityo of death. Kridanaka. Playthings. Niripaha. The king. Translation, and we'll read a few verses here to get to the purport, which I think is after the fourth verse. Yeah. Shukadeva Goswami said, seeing the kings of this earth busy trying to conquer her, the earth herself laughed. She said, just see how these kings, who are actually playthings in the hands of death, are desiring to conquer me. 2. Great rulers of men, even those who are learned, meet frustration and failure because of material lust. Driven by lust, these kings place great hope and faith in the dead lump of flesh called the body, even though the material frame is as fleeting as bubbles of foam on the water. Text verses 3 and 4. Kings and politicians imagine, first I will conquer my senses and mind. Then I will subdue my chief ministers and rid myself of the thorn pricks of my advisors, citizens, friends, and relatives, as well as the keepers of my elephants. In this way I will gradually conquer the entire earth, because the hearts of these leaders are bound by great expectation. They fail to see death waiting nearby. Purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. To satisfy their greed for power, determined politicians, dictators, and military leaders undergo severe austerities and sacrifice. With much self-discipline, then they lead their great nations in a struggle to control the sea, land, air, and space. Although the politicians and their followers will soon be dead, since birth and death are all inevitable in this world, they perish in their frenetic struggle for ephemeral glory.
Shri Chaitanya Mano Vistam Svapitam Jaina Vrutane Svayam Rupa Gadamayam Padati Svapatantikam Vaitrakal Patru Vishcham Kripa Sindhu Vyevacham Tatitinam Bhavane Vyo Vaishnave Vyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Siyadvaita Giradhar Shivasari Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hari 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 Ram 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 Hari Hari Mukum Guru Tivachalam Pangunaga Yategirim Yatkripata Mahambande Shigurum Dinataranam Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Srimate Tamaho Krishna Goswamini Pinamane Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Askata De Satarane. Everybody's sitting to the side. So if I look straight out, it's just the door. Anyway, so such a beautiful introduction to this chapter and understanding what's about to happen. Bhumi is the earth planet. She's the goddess of the earth planet. It's also called Bhu, B-H-U. And Bhumi is the possessive form. Bhumi, I am the earth. I control the earth. So she is the controller. None of the kings get to be the controller of the earth. Right? And due to their foolishness, the kings, gradually Bhumi proves that point by not producing foodstuff.
Which means if foodstuff is not growing and being provided by the earth, what's left? Animals. And the predominant animal in charge of everything? Who is he going to eat? Gradually, according to the Bhagavatam, they begin to eat their own children. That's how misguided the powerful, relatively powerful people in Kali Yuga become. Because they're starting everything on a false premise that I am a king. Right? And they say, every man, what is it that they say about houses? I've ridden that out of my head so much. Every man's house is his castle. Right? And all the living entities there in that house, the wife, the children, the relatives, they're subjects. And we see here, it's describing how gradually they'll want to get rid of them because they give him advice that has to do with something other than their particular sense gratification. So therefore, they're not good advisors. They want money from me. They want this. They want that. And they gradually eliminate their entire families and friends, counselors, etc. Due to this false premise, I own everything. So how does anything work if we think it's all mine? What's more frustrating than thinking something you own breaks? Or someone you think you own just won't do what you said. It's very simple, dear. You just put this thing back here every day, that place. Why can't you do that? And it becomes a gross argument over just the placement of some other material thing. Or the children. Do this, make your life like this, make your life like this. And how often do the children do that? The children do it to a point that they find what they want to do with their life, and then they go and do it. I mean, we see here in this room, we somehow made the choice to become a devotee. How astounding is that? And I'm sure all of our parents at the time were very happy that we weren't going to become materially successful, and we were just going to live in the temple, and we were just going to be supported by other people, and on and on and on and on. Even within Western religions, like who goes to the priesthood anymore? You were raised in a Catholic culture, right? Yeah, what do they say if their daughter becomes a nun? They don't like it either. When Lokanath Maharaj joined, he was from a little village in Marathi. So Bombay is Maratha? Yeah. So he was a Marathi. And his sister told him, if you don't come back home, Raghu, I will commit suicide. You have to come back. You have to take care of the family. Our parents are old. It is your duty. You're the son. Da, 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 on the way. In India, right? One would think, oh, my son has become a sannyasi. I am so proud. It takes time to adjust to that. In America, same thing. You join the priesthood. I mean, it used to be. The nice Irish Catholics. Irish are more pious than most Western, most white Catholics. They always would try to have at least one of their children and, well, thank you, and one of their sons, one of their sons or daughters to become a nun or a priest. They want to give at least one of their children to the priesthood. Not easy to do anymore. Nobody thinks like that. They think you're crazy. We're all crazy here. But we're crazy for Krishna. Wrote a pamphlet back in the 60s. Who's crazy? And he denotes that everybody that thinks they're the body are completely crazy. Everybody that thinks their body is for Krishna is crazy for Krishna. So who's not crazy? Everybody's crazy. Crazy is something we think in terms of that person's different from me. That's all. It has no validity in science or anything of the sort. Everyone suffers in this material world. And yes, it makes everyone anxious. It makes everyone afraid. It makes everyone angry. It does so many things to every individual person. Oh, again. Sorry, Mishra. He gets on my case, too. So we all suffer in this world for the simple point that I think I'm more than I am. And relate that to something that is absolutely incorrect, completely less than what we are. If we are spirit soul, then we are automatically the servant of Krishna. Krishna Jivarasrupoi Krishna Nityadas. So automatically we are a devotee of Krishna if we accept our identity as the soul. If we don't accept our identity of the soul, and rather we try to produce a idea that I am my body, and all of those things that I can possess with my body, all of those things that I control with my body, the more I have, the bigger I become. But that's wrong, because the body is subject to the three modes of material nature. The body is subject to the cycle of birth and death. The body is suffered. It is all kind of problems. So here it says, this king, I will control, learn to control my mind and senses. Why is that so important? On one level, we can say one must be determined and focused, etc. And that's a very common, easy to understand concept of controlling the mind and senses. However, in this verse, and we can correlate it to Krishna's instructions in the Bhagavad Gita, that based on our previous ideas and desires and karmas, we get a particular set of senses first, which are controlled or grouped, it says, around the mind. This is Krishna's instructions on how we take our birth in the material world. We have desires, unfulfilled actions. We have so many karmic things that we've done towards that goal of whatever we wanted to do with our body in that last life. So with these, Krishna puts us with a certain group of senses that we can enjoy. And he groups them around the mind because the mind's business, for the most part, is to engage the senses in their sense objects. Last I checked, there are very few kings in the world, presidents, prime ministers, who have controlled their mind and senses so that when they get there, their minds are controlled and they don't engage in all of this sense gratification, right? They all do. They live like kings, right? That's what everybody says. Ah, this guy lives like a king. He's wealth. The guy down the street, right? Why? Because they know, if I was a king, I can enjoy like they are. And that's all they're thinking. So where is this control of the mind and senses thing coming from? You know, we have to, if we are going to embody ourselves within a material body and identify with that body as the self, we are going to have to spend most of our life trying to make our nice little sets of senses happy. And they do get happy. For how long at a time, right? They don't walk much anymore, but when you walk past a bread shop, a bakery, you can't help but having your mind just a little bit agitated. It smells so nice. Huh? The word in Sanskrit for food and grain is anna, same thing. Hearing, smelling these nice chapatis being made or some wonderful bread or cake or cookies being made or the donut shop, you just think, oh, that would be very good to eat. I will bring some for my family. And then you'll eat half of them on the way home. Right? Or whatever. You see the senses. And then what happens then? Oh, but you know, this bread would be really good with the little queso, you know, some cheese. Little cotija, maybe some, I don't know, banana. I eat all these I eat Latin American cheeses. I gave up Western cheeses. But anyway, so we think so many different ways that we can enjoy that bread. A little peanut butter, some jam, a little of this, that, and the other. If you're a little more gross, you can have salami, bologna, all these really interesting things that if you really get into it, you don't know what's in there. You do know what it's wrapped in, and we're not going to mention that in front of the deities. So we think so many things that are just incorrect based on this one premise: I'm important because I took my birth. Therefore, I should be king. Control my mind and senses to get to be a king. And it is true. You have to focus to attain just about anything in this world. That is true. But if you're simply possessing on the basis of bodily connection, it will just be a source of misery in the long run. Because Krishna says, if you are born, you will die. If you die, you will take birth. You will be born. You die, you're born, you're dead. You die, over and over. This is called the samsara chakra, birth, death, old days, and deeds. It's a wheel. You never get off it. But gradually, if you really play your cards right, you'll get your name on a long list of other names, which may or may not do anything for you. What do we really think of history? Oh, I have to learn that date, that person, right? We don't even present it well. And therefore, we do it again and again. It never goes away. That's history. So if we don't want to strive for more, and we're going to hear what Bhumi thinks, what the planet thinks of one's misidentification with the body. I mean, look what the earth has to endure to allow human beings to live. And look how many things change, right? Because we all did study our history in school. We remember the pyramids in Egypt, right? They're a big deal. No one knows how they're built. They were buried under sand. How long do you think it takes something as large as a pyramid to get buried by sand? Huh? There's also the Jagannath Priyanatakam describes that even the Jagannath temple was buried in sand when Maharaj, Indradyumna Maharaj went to Brahma to petition him to come and do the Pratishpratan to bring the deity, give life to the deity. And he was gone so long that he came back and the temple wasn't there. It was covered in sand. It takes a long time, 1,000 years for him. So everything changes and becomes useless, because even though the pyramids are such wonderful structures, right? No one lives in them. No one does anything with them. They go there and look and gape and wish they could get a piece of it or whatever. Okay, so that's Egypt. Then you have India. So many ancient temples in India. So many ancient sites in China. So many ancient sites in the Americas. In Africa, there are great civilizations in accordance to the Vedic descriptions in previous ages that lived everywhere in the world. And we see the remnants of them, except that no one living remembered them. They just kind of stumbled over them at some point. Right? It's quite interesting. Like if it was already established as a city, where'd it go? Why'd it go? And yet we find these structures that are thousands of years old. And we can't even figure out how they built them. However, we've progressed, modern man, into much more intelligent, civilized beings by their own admission. But then they can't build a pyramid. They can't build a Machu Picchu in Peru. They can't build the huge mounds and civilizations that were there in the Mississippi Valley in the United States. Right? They discovered... and they have a replica of it down in Houston. This one emperor in China had thousands of soldiers made out of clay, and then he buried them all, or they got buried. No one even remembered that that happened. They just kind of stumbled over it. So whatever we have in this Kali Yuga is not nearly as great. It's what's come before us in the Satya-yuga when the mode of goodness and religiosity prevailed. I mean, everything we're doing is leading to the destruction of the world. Our agricultural systems, our transportation systems, all of these different things are leading to degradation of the world. I mean, you can say, oh, in the Vedic times, they were primitive. They rode horses and chariots. They used wood, a renewable resource. They used horses, and wherever horses go, they fertilize the land. Right? So rather than, even though they're expending energy, they were rebirthing energy and rebirthing the planet by just being capable of using proper natural products that the earth is giving freely because the people are religious, saintly, they're pious, they study the scriptures, they do all the wonderful things a religious person should do. And therefore, vegetables, fruits, and all these different things are much more nutritious. It's all a really nice place, this earth. But we become bewildered by it because inevitably we will manifest some degree of greed and avarice and envy and these other qualities, particularly as we move towards the Kali Yuga, which we're about to find out about. Right? We see all these things happening. When you read the descriptions of how bad Kali Yuga gets, you hear things like there are clouds with lightning and thunder and no rain. So what is that? What would be a cloud without moisture? I mean, in our experience, Krishna's wonderful system of water purification and storage is that you store your water with salt. The oceans, correct? They're all salty. And as the sun beats down on the surface of the oceans, the water comes up as distilled, pure water, and forms clouds, which carry that water over the land and showers the water back down onto the land so that there's plenty of water that we can drink. Perfect system, isn't it? We breathe in oxygen and breathe out carbon monoxide, and then the plants breathe in carbon monoxide and breathe out oxygen. We need. So everything is related to the natural processes of purification and sustenance. And this is what Bhumi Devi gives. Freely. With no pollution. I mean, wow, didn't we improve things? But then you really, when you read these symptoms of what's going to go on, you can see that those clouds are going to be consisted of particulates and smoke. Where's that going to come from? I don't know. Maybe all those refineries down in Houston. Not all of them. I mean, there's lots of them everywhere. But you go to Houston, you actually, for 6 months at a time, usually you don't see most of the major stars in the sky. But all day long you see these beautiful blue skies. But you realize actually there's a low cloud hanging over the entire city that keeps us from actually seeing the light of the stars at night. It's not just the light pollution that they have also. It differs. Anyway. I'm not trying to give a big environmental class here, but this is the reality. Krishna and the demigods work conjointly to make a wonderful universe. An uncivilized man comes along and destroys that. Out of his pride of his position as a powerful material body only. That's what it's all about. Any questions? I'll let somebody else pontificate on the chanting of the holy names, which was mentioned in the introduction. Because we do have in ticket out, that's chanting Hare Krishna. So it's not so glum, but we should see how the glum gets to us. I have a microphone today, and I'm here by myself.
Hare Krishna.
Anyway.
I have a question. In the beginning, in the summary, it was subduing the six internal senses and five senses of the mind. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, the six internal enemies are the five senses and the mind.
Yeah, five.
We're stuck with them. So either, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, it's going to be our friends or they're going to be our enemies. Therefore, it's mentioned also that we should conquer the mind and senses. They will get us off point. You know, if any of your senses, your touch, your taste, your sight, all of these things, right? Smell, any of those get agitated, you immediately flow. So therefore you have to control them so that you can think properly. And actually Prabhupada describes this as the regulative principles of freedom in the Bhagavad Gita. Regulative principles and freedom don't seem to be compatible. But if you don't regulate your senses and you don't control the mind, you can't make a choice with the intelligence because the mind and senses will rule out what you do every day. You know, like devotees will say, I have trouble chanting my rounds. You have trouble controlling your mind. There is 24 hours in every single day. You only have to chant for two of them. That leaves you 20 other hours to take care of that glorious body that we all have. We all come in stuff. And to do whatever work we do. And of course to do all our banking so we can store this up till ad infinitum. But without controlling the mind and senses, we do other things instead. We watch television, we read other books, we do this, we chit-chat, we do so many things. That's what distracts us from our day. You know, actually our own president here, Nityananda Prabhu, when talking to Tamal Krishna Goswami in Fiji, he says, you know, and he was a very big, important person there. He was on all these government boards and things. A young man, mid-20s, you know. And he said, I just can't find the time. So Tamal Krishna Goswami restructured how he spends. He says, how do you spend your day? Give me your schedule. And he shifted a few things around, which opened up 2 hours for his chanting. And he just went, my goodness. If there is a desire, one can find the time. But we have to have that desire every single day. That's where it's complicated. We get distracted. Simple as that. Distracted. I'm as guilty as everyone. We get distracted. Therefore, there are internal enemies. You just can't get rid of them. You can control them by giving them regulated enjoyment. Here we all are today. Now, I don't see everybody here every day that I see now. And all of us are filling our eyes up with Radha Kala Chanji. Right? How nice. I mean, I used to think, I got in the habit, I practically don't look at mirrors in the morning, even. Because I just can't imagine looking at me in the morning when I could, you know, quickly run away to the temple and see Krishna. And I can't imagine how miserable life must be without that. You know, our Bhakta Sam here, he takes a bike to a train, to a bike, to a bus, to the bike, to the temple every single day. Every single day. Because he wants to see Krishna. He could do lots of other things, like sleep. That trip takes a lot of time. You got to wake up early. Yeah, and everybody knows this. What we will do with this knowledge is our choice. That's our free will. Everybody loves to see Krishna. But to love Krishna, one has to give up all material conception. Not easy. And what keeps us from that is, oh, I have something else I have to do. Mind and senses. So the regulation of bhakti yoga is that we give our senses something wonderful to eat, prasadam. We give them something wonderful to see, Krishna. We give them something wonderful to hear. Kirtan, Krishna Katha. Just being friends with the devotees engages your touch. In the sense, not that we're all huggy-buggy like the material world out there, but our hearts are touched by the association of devotees. It helps so much. It's real touch, eternal touch, when our hearts become open to associating with the devotees and enjoying Krishna prasadam and kirtan and shastra and so many other things. Then we develop actual love. We develop desire that I just want Krishna. I don't want something else. So that's how we get there. All of us. Young, old, man, woman, dog, cat. I mean, look at this cat over here. The thing is enormous. It just sits around. And now when he goes and he looks in the kitchen, come on, isn't it time for prasadam? Somebody's got to, you know, because somebody always feeds them when they eat. I'll save a little for the cat. You know, it even knows. It's got the program down. If I just sit here in this Hare Krishna courtyard, I'll eat. I'll sleep. Everything will be fine. And they're guaranteed to get a human birth in their next life. You know, I mean, we always like to think the reverse of that. This cat must have been a devotee. Must have. Blew it. Not making that mistake again. It's going to make it back. It's going to stay in the association. It's going to take prasadam. Maharaj Bharat, who became a deer, became Jadbarana. He became a deer and went and lived near a hermitage and simply ate whatever they threw out. That's prasadam. You can't eat all the prasadam we offer to Krishna. Krishna can eat unlimited amounts. We can't. Therefore, there's always some wastage. And therefore, the deer form of Maharaj Bharat would stay at the hermitage and eat only what they throw away. So animals, yes, they have an interesting consciousness. It's not as sharp, but when we're advanced and we make a mistake and we somehow, by Krishna's grace, we take birth as an animal, that gets the association of devotees. It's Krishna being kind to us and good to us. But when you think back on it, or even if you project yourself into that, you think that's not very nice. And therefore, that gives us a reason to question Krishna's goodness. That's the mind. That's the mind. It's not our friend most of the time. It's our friend when we're eating prasadam. It's all over it. So, what do we need to do? Prasadam, kirtan, association, like that. And engage our intellect by understanding Srila Prabhupada's books. It's the key to everything. Prabhupada was perfect. Everything he did to spread Krishna consciousness was perfect and therefore worked perfectly, save and except for the fact that each individual living entity has a mind, and that created untold problems in the process of conquering the world with Krishna consciousness. Solution to everything is in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Nice if you can really study thoroughly and diligently every day, but even just keep reading every day. Like, there's sections of the Bhagavatam. There's a nice verse. When Krishna defeats Bhomasura. And how am I tying that in? Because Bhomasura was who? Who was his mother? Bhumi. The earth. He was born of the earth. Became a demon. Kidnapped 16,100 princesses. And when Krishna went to kill the demon, on the permission of Rukmini, who is also a manifestation of Bhumi Devi. Bhomasura had a boon that he could not be killed without the permission of his mother. Right? So what mother do we know that's going to say, yeah, go kill my son? They don't do that. I mean, they might be corrupted now and they've lost their conditioning, but mothers would never do that to their child. So even he's a big, ugly, nasty demon that's corrupted and stolen away 16,100 young girls. When Krishna goes to kill him, he doesn't bring his army. Really, he just flies there with Garuda and Rukmini. Because Rukmini can give permission. And he never asks, can I kill him? She saw how terrible this guy was and she said, kill him. Just kill him. Stop playing with him, Krishna. Just kill him. So he did. Now, back to the actual point we're trying to deal with, but I wanted to get it understood who this is. So then he's got these 16,100 princesses with nowhere to go. They've been stolen away by somebody. So they said, we only want you, Krishna. So he goes, okay, follow me. And he arranges all these elephants from the celestial world with four sets of tusks and two trunks, and there were 64 elephants. He loaded them all up. And they hauled them all back to Dwarka. And then he had a wedding. One wedding, separately existing, with each and every one of his very newly acquired young princesses to be his queen. Then it describes, in a couple of subsequent verses from that, that Krishna not only went to these weddings, but his whole family and entourage went to every single one of these 16,108 weddings all at the same time. Can anyone logically wrap their mind around that possibility? That Krishna can have a wedding, 16,108 simultaneous weddings, and all his family members go and experience each wedding separately at the same time. Is that logical? Can we believe it just on face value? These are questions. I'm not going to say the offensive side of that answer. The purport to that verse, the devotees don't come in at all. They simply write what Vishwanath Chakravarti, Vishnu Swami, and others, Sridhar Swami, all said about it. And he said, this is a suspension of logic. Okay, so if you can't comprehend it, what can you do? You can accept it. And you can accept that this is proof Krishna is God. Not complicated, is it? We already know Krishna is God. But rather than questioning what Krishna does as God, accept this is God doing what God does. He's in the heart of every living entity, therefore he knows what's going on. Therefore he can make everything what he wants it to be. This is why we come into the material world. We want to control like Krishna. Krishna controls his whole environment and everyone in it by their choice. As soon as we start thinking, I want to be like Krishna, then that means you have to be a controller. And you don't get to control things with Krishna. He controls it. Therefore, you come to the material world. So reading Prabhupada's books is not a matter of understanding all the time. It's a matter of accepting that this is Krishna. The Bhagavatam itself is Krishna. And everything in it is Krishna, and it is perfect. Even though the grammar may be not perfect. And there's a verse in the early part of the Bhagavatam that states that. Even though not correct in terms of its structure, everything in it is correct. This is the Bhagavatam. Or it says, what is it? It's improperly composed, like placed in a book form or spoken. It may be a little different, but the lessons are the same. This is what Prabhupada gave the world. This was his secret weapon to take over the world, because these books are still here and they're still functioning perfectly well in delivering the living entities. We have a reading program in Houston where we read every night. We've been doing it now for 2.5 years. We're working towards, this summer will be our third year. And it started with Keshava Bari Maharaj. And he, because he reads every, he made this vow a year before us, or 2 years before he started doing this from place to place. And we simply read minor comments for clarification in terms of who these personalities are, or why this thing is being mentioned. Minor explanations, not classes. We actually read for an hour, hour and a half. And in the course of 4 months last year, we made 6 devotees. Just from reading and hearing Srila Prabhupada's books every day. So if you want to know how to control the mind and senses and make them your friends, you read Prabhupada's books. Read them out loud. Understand everything that you can possibly understand, back and forth, go into some of the points. But if you don't understand a particular thing, don't find fault. Simply find fault in your inability to understand it yet. Keep reading, and when you get to the end of the Bhagavatam, which we're getting close to, next chapter, I think, is Maharaj Parikshit. No, the 4 categories of universal annihilation, and then Shukadev Goswami's final instructions to Maharaj Parikshit. Then Maharaj Parikshit passes away. That's where we're going with this Bhagavatam section now. And this is the 12th canto after 11 other cantos and so many volumes and volumes and volumes of books. So we just have to do that. Just read with the understanding that we will get Krishna. And every instruction we need to get Krishna is in this book. Instructions that may not be relevant in our perception, you keep reading them and know that it's relative to somebody else. Every single person on the planet, if they read this Srimad Bhagavatam, will in fact come to know Krishna, love Krishna, and be delivered back to the spiritual world. And in this age of Kali, it is such a boon to have this. Because as we heard in the introduction, as you were talking about, you asked about, the nice thing here is that just by chanting, it's sufficient. But most of us do not have motivation to stop doing everything else we're doing in chanting, do we? Therefore, we have to understand why we should do that. And that's the Bhagavatam. That's a little more of an answer than you thought you were going to get.
Thank you.
But it's the answer. It's actually on us. But only with Krishna's help and the devotees' help. But we have to have the determination and the direction ourselves. We have to move in that direction. Anyone else? Question? No, now we're thinking, God, I got to go to work. I hope he talks less. Kantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jaya. I will.